Celia sat up too. We faced each other and held hands. "I think you should probably perform the ceremony," she said. "I suppose I have been in more weddings," I joked. She laughed and I laughed with her. We were in our mid-50s, giddy at the idea of finally doing what we should have done years ago. "Okay," I said, "no more laughing. We're gonna do it." "Okay," she said, smiling. "I'm ready." I breathed in. I looked at her. She had crow's feet around her eyes. She had laugh lines around her mouth. Her hair was mussed from the pillow. She was wearing an old New York Giants t-shirt with a hole in the shoulder. Convention be damned, she never looked more beautiful. "Dearly beloved," I said. "I suppose that's just us." "Okay," Celia said, "I follow. We are gathered here today to celebrate the union of us." "Great." "Two people who come together to spend the rest of their lives with each other." "Agreed." "Do you, Celia, take me, Evelyn, to be your wedded wife, in sickness and in health, for richer and for poorer, till death do us part, as long as we both shall live?" She smiled at me. "I do." "And do I, Evelyn, take you, Celia, to be my wedded wife, in sickness and in health and all the other stuff?" "I do." I realized there was a slight hiccup. "Wait, we don't have rings." Celia looked around for something that might suffice. Without taking my hands from her, I checked the nightstand. "Here," Celia said, taking the hair tie from her head. I laughed and took mine out of my ponytail. "Okay," I said. "Celia, repeat after me. Evelyn, take this ring as a symbol of my never-ending love." "Evelyn, take this ring as a symbol of my never-ending love." Celia took the hair tie and wrapped it around my finger 3 times. "Say, with this ring I thee wed. With this ring I thee wed." "Okay, now I do it. Celia, take this ring as a symbol of my never-ending love. With this ring I thee wed." I put my hair tie on her finger. "Oh, I forgot vows. Should we do vows?" "We can," she said, "if you want to." "Okay," I said. "You think of what you want to say. I'll think, too." "I don't need to think," she said. "I'm ready. I know." "Okay," I said, surprised to find that my heart was beating quickly, eager to hear her words. "Go." "Evelyn, I have been in love with you since 1959. I may not have always shown it. I may have let other things get in the way. But know that I have loved you that long, that I have never stopped, and that I never will." I closed my eyes briefly, letting her words sink in. And then I gave her mine. "I have been married 7 times, and never once has it felt half as right as this. I think that loving you has been the truest thing about me." She smiled so hard I thought she might cry, but she didn't. I said, "By the power vested in me by us, I now declare us married." Celia laughed. "I may now kiss the bride," I said, and I let go of her hands, grabbed her face, and kissed her. My wife. 6 years later. After Celia and I had spent more than a decade together on the beaches of Spain, after Connor had graduated from college and taken a job on Wall Street, after the world had all but forgotten about Little Women and Bout en Train and Celia's 3 Oscars, Cecilia Jameson died of respiratory failure. She was in my arms, in our bed. It was summer. The windows were open to let in the breeze. The room smelled of sickness, but if you focused hard enough, you could still smell the salt from the ocean. Her eyes went still. I called out for the nurse who had been downstairs in the kitchen. I think I stopped making memories again in those moments when Celia was being taken from me. I only remember clinging to her, holding her as best I could. I only remember saying, "We didn't have enough time." It felt as if by taking her body, the paramedics were ripping out my soul. And then when the door shut, when everyone had left, when Celia was nowhere to be seen, I looked over at Robert. I fell to the floor. The tiles felt cold on my flushed skin. The hardness of the stone ached in my bones. Underneath me, puddles of tears were forming, and yet I could not lift my head off the ground. Robert did not help me up. He got down on the floor next to me and wept. I had lost her, my love, my Celia, my soulmate, the woman whose love I'd spent my life earning. Simply gone, irrevocably and forever. And the devastating luxury of panic overtook me again.
Now this. July 5th, 2000. Screen queen Celia St. James has died. Three-time Oscar-winning actress Celia St. James died last week of complications related to emphysema. She was 61 years old. From a well-to-do family in a small town in Georgia, the red-haired St. James was often referred to as the Georgia Peach early in her career. But it was her role as Beth in the 1959 adaptation of Little Women that brought her first Academy Award and turned her into a bona fide star. St. James would go on to be nominated 4 other times and take home the trophy twice more over the next 30 years. For Best Actress in 1970 for Our Men, and for Best Supporting Actress for her role as Lady Macbeth in the 1988 adaptation of the Shakespearean tragedy. In addition to her remarkable talent, St. James was known for her girl-next-door allure and her 15-year marriage to football hero John Braverman. The two divorced in the late 1970s, but remained friendly until Braverman's passing in 1980. She never remarried. St. James's estate is to be managed by her brother Robert Jameson, husband of actress and St. James's former co-star Evelyn Hugo.
Celia, like Harry, was buried in Forest Lawn in Los Angeles. Robert and I held her funeral on a Thursday morning. It was kept private, but people knew we were there. They knew she was being laid to rest. When she was lowered to the ground, I stared at the hole in the earth. I stared at the glossy sheen of the wood of her casket. I could not keep it in. I could not keep my true self from coming out. "I need a minute," I said to Robert and Connor, and then I turned away. I walked, farther and farther up the winding hillside roads of the cemetery, until I found what I was looking for. Harry Cameron. I sat down at his tombstone, and I cried out everything within me. I cried until I felt depleted. I did not say a single thing. I did not feel any need. I had talked to Harry in my head and my heart for so long, for so many years, that it felt as if we transcended words. He had been the one to help me, to support me through everything in my life, and now I needed him more than ever. So I went to him the only way I knew how. I let him heal me as only he could. And then I stood up, dusted off my skirt, and turned around. There in the trees were 2 paparazzi taking my photo. I was neither angry nor flattered. I simply didn't care. It cost so much, caring. I didn't have any currency to spend on it. Instead, I walked away. 2 weeks later, after Robert and I had gone home to Aldis, Connor sent me a magazine with the image of me at Harry's grave on the cover. She had attached a note to the front. It said simply, "I love you." I pulled off the note and read the headline, "Legend: Evelyn Hugo weeps at Harry Cameron's grave years later." Even long past my prime, people were still easily distracted from seeing how I felt about Celia St. James, but this time was different, because I wasn't hiding anything. The truth had been there for them to grab if they'd paid attention. I had been my truest self, searching for the help of my best friend to ease the pain of the loss of my lover. But of course they got it wrong. They never did care about getting it right. The media are going to tell whatever story they want to tell. They always have. They always will. It was then that I knew that the only time anyone would know anything true about my life was when I told them directly. In a book. I saved Connor's note and threw the magazine in the trash. With Celia's passing and Harry gone, and myself finally in a marriage that, while chaste, was stable, my life officially became entirely void of scandal. Me, Evelyn Hugo, a boring old lady. Robert and I lived a friendly marriage for the next 11 years. We moved back to Manhattan in the mid-2000s to be closer to Connor. We refinished this apartment. We donated some of Celia's money to LGBTQ+ organizations and lung disease research. Every Christmas we threw a benefit for homeless youth organizations in New York City. After years on a quiet beach, it was nice to be members of society again in some ways. But all I really cared about was Connor. She had worked her way up the ladder at Merrill Lynch, and then, shortly after Robert and I moved back to New York, she admitted to him that she hated the culture of finance. She told him she had to leave. He was disappointed that she hadn't been happy with what had made him happy. That was obvious. But he was never disappointed in her. And he was the first person to congratulate her when she took a job teaching at Wharton. She never knew that he had made a few calls on her behalf. He never wanted her to know. He merely wanted to help her in any and all ways that he could, and he did that, lovingly, until he died at age 81. Connor gave the eulogy. Her boyfriend, Greg, was one of the pallbearers. Afterward, she and Greg came to stay with me for a while. "Mom, after 7 husbands, I'm not sure you've had any practice living on your own," she said, as she sat at my dining room table, the same table she used to sit at in a high chair with Harry, Celia, John, and me. "I lived a very full life before you were born," I told her. "I lived alone once, and I can do it again. You and Greg should go live your lives, really." But the moment I shut the door behind them, I realized just how huge this apartment was, just how quiet. That's when I hired Grace. I had inherited multiple millions from Harry, Celia, and now Robert. And I had only Connor to spoil, so I also spoiled Grace and her family. It gave me happiness to give them happiness, to give them just a little bit of the luxury I'd had for most of my life. Living alone isn't so bad once you get used to it, and living in a big apartment like this, well, I've kept it because I wanted to give it to Connor, but I have enjoyed some aspects of it. Of course, I always liked it more when Connor would spend the night, especially after she and Greg broke up. You can make quite a life for yourself, hosting charity dinners and collecting art. You can find a way to be happy with whatever the truth is. Until your daughter dies. Connor was diagnosed with late-stage breast cancer 2.5 years ago when she was 39. She was given months to live. I knew what it was like to realize that the one you love would leave this earth well before you. But nothing could prepare me for the pain of watching my child suffer. I held her when she puked from the chemo. I wrapped her in blankets when she was so cold she was crying. I kissed her forehead like she was my baby again, because she was forever my baby. I told her every single day that her life had been the world's greatest gift to me, that I believed I was put on earth not to make movies or wear emerald green gowns and wave at crowds, but to be her mother. I sat next to her hospital bed. "Nothing I have ever done," I said, has made me as proud as the day I gave birth to you." "I know," she said. "I've always known that." I had made a point of not bullshitting her ever since her father died. We had the sort of relationship where we believed each other, believed in each other. She knew she was loved. She knew that she had changed my life, that she had changed the world. She made it 18 months before she passed away. And when they put her in the ground next to her father, I broke like I have never broken before. The devastating luxury of panic overtook me, and it has never left. That's how my story ends, with the loss of everyone I have ever loved, with me in a big, beautiful Upper East Side apartment missing everyone who ever meant anything to me. When you write the ending, Monique, make sure it's clear that I don't love this apartment, that I don't care about all my money, that I couldn't give a rat's ass if people think I'm a legend, that the adoration of millions of people never warmed my bed. When you write the ending, Monique, tell everyone that it is the people I miss. Tell everyone that I got it wrong, that I chose the wrong things most of the time. When you write the ending, Monique, make sure the reader understands that all I was ever really looking for was family. Make sure it's clear that I found it. Make sure they know that I am heartbroken without it. Spell it out if you have to. Say that Evelyn Hugo doesn't care if everyone forgets her name. Evelyn Hugo doesn't care if everyone forgets she was ever alive. Better yet, remind them that Evelyn Hugo never existed. She was a person I made up for them, so that they would love me. Tell them that I was confused for a very long time about what love was. Tell them that I understand it now, and I don't need their love anymore. Say to them, Evelyn Hugo just wants to go home. It's time for her to go to her daughter and her lover and her best friend and her mother. Tell them Evelyn Hugo says goodbye.
What do you mean, goodbye? Don't say goodbye, Evelyn. She looks me right in the eye and ignores my words.
When you put it all together into one narrative, she says, make sure it's clear that of all the things I did to protect my family, I would do every one again. And I would have done more, would have behaved even uglier if I thought it could have saved them.
I think most people probably feel the same way, I tell her, about their lives, their loved ones. Evelyn looks disappointed in my response. She gets up and walks over to her desk. She pulls out a piece of paper. It is old, crinkled and folded, with a burnt orange hue on one edge.
"The man in the car with Harry," Evelyn says. "The one I left." This is, of course, the most egregious thing she's ever done. But I'm not sure I wouldn't have done the same for someone I loved. I'm not saying I would have done the same. I'm just saying that I'm not sure. Harry had fallen in love with a black man. His name was James Grant. He died on February 26, 1989.
Here's the thing about fury. It starts in your chest. It starts as fear. Fear quickly moves to denial.
No, that must be a mistake. No, that can't be.
And then the truth hits. Yes, she's right. Yes, it can be. Because you realize, yes, it is true. And then you have a choice. Are you sad or are you angry? And ultimately, the thin line between the two comes down to the answer to one question. Can you assign blame? The loss of my father, when I was 7, was something for which I only ever had one person to blame, my father. My father was driving drunk. He'd never done anything like it before. It was entirely out of character, but it happened. And I could either hate him for it, or I could try to understand it.
Your father was driving under the influence and lost control of the car.
But this? The knowledge that my father never willingly got behind the wheel of a car drunk, that he was left dead on the side of the road by this woman, framed for his own death, his legacy tarnished? The fact that I grew up believing he'd been the one to cause the accident. There is so much blame hanging in the air, waiting for me to snatch it and pin it on Evelyn's chest. And the way she is sitting in front of me, remorseful but not exactly sorry, makes it clear she's ready to be pinned. This blame is like a flint to my years of aching, and it erupts into fury. My body goes white hot, my eyes tear, my hands ball into fists, and I step away because I'm afraid of what I might do. And then because stepping away from her feels too generous, I edge back to where she is and I push her against the sofa and I say, I'm glad you have no one left. I'm glad there's no one alive to love you. I let go of her, surprised at myself. She sits back up. She watches me. You think that giving me your story makes up for any of it? I ask her. All this time you've been making me sit here, listening to your life so that you could confess, and you think that your biography makes up for it?
No, she says. I think you know me well enough by now to know I'm not nearly naive enough to believe in absolution.
What then? Evelyn reaches out and shows me the paper in her hand.
I found this in Harry's pants pocket the night he died. My guess is that he'd read it, and it was the reason he'd been drinking so much to begin with. It was from your father.
So I
found great peace in my daughter knowing the truth about me. There was immense comfort in knowing the real her. I wanted to. I think I'm the only person alive who can give that to you. Can give it to your dad. I want you to know who he truly was.
I know who he was to me, I say, while realizing that that's not exactly true.
I thought you would want to know all of him. Take it, Monique. Read the letter. If you don't want it, you don't have to keep it. But I always planned on sending it to you. I always thought you deserved to know. I snatch it from her, not wanting even to extend the kindness of taking it gently. I sit down. I open it. There are what can only be blood stains on the top of the page. I wonder briefly if it's my father's blood, or Harry's. I decide not to think about it. Before I can read even one line, I look up at her. Can you leave? I say. Evelyn nods and walks out of her own office. She shuts the door behind her. I look down. There is so much to reframe in my mind. My father did nothing wrong. My father didn't cause his own death. I've spent years of my life seeing him from that angle, making peace with him through that lens. And now, for the first time in nearly 30 years, I have new words, fresh thoughts from my father. Dear Harry, I love you. I love you in a way that I never thought possible. I've spent so much of my life thinking that this type of love was a myth. And now here it is, so real, I can touch it. And I finally understand what the Beatles were singing about all those years. I do not want you to move to Europe, but I also know that what I may not want may very well be the best thing for you. So despite my desires, I think you should go. I cannot and will not be able to give you the life you are dreaming of here in Los Angeles. I cannot marry Celia St. James, although I do agree with you that she is a stunningly beautiful woman. And if I'm being honest, I did nurse a small crush on her in Royal Wedding.
But the fact remains that though I have never loved my wife the way I love you, I will never leave her. I love my family too much to fracture us for even a moment of time. My daughter, whom I desperately hope you can one day meet, is my reason for living, and I know that she is happiest with me and her mom. I know that she will live her best life only if I stay where I am. Angela is perhaps not the love of my life. I know that now that I've felt real passion. But I think in many ways she means to me what Evelyn means to you. She is my best friend, my confidant, my companion. I admire the forthrightness with which you and Evelyn discuss your sexuality, your desires. But it is not how Angela and I work, and I'm not sure I'd want to change that. We do not have a vibrant sex life, but I love her the way one loves a partner. I would never forgive myself for causing her pain, and I would find myself desperate to call her, to hear her thoughts, to know how she is every moment of every day if I was not with her. My family is my heart, and I cannot break us up. Not even for the type of love that I've found with you, my Harry. Go to Europe, if you believe it is what is best for your family, and know that here in Los Angeles, I am with mine, thinking of you. Forever yours, James. I put down the letter. I stare straight ahead into the air. And then, and only then, it hits me. My father was in love with a man. I don't know how long I sit on the couch, staring at the ceiling. I think of the memories of my dad, the way he would throw me up in the air in the backyard, the way he would every once in a while let me eat banana splits for breakfast. Those memories have always been tinged by how he died. They have always had a bitter sweetness to them, because I believed it was his mistakes that took him from me too soon. And now I don't know what to make of him. I don't know how to think of him. A defining trait is gone and is replaced by so much more, for better or for worse. At some point after I start replaying the same images over and over in my mind, memories of my father alive, imagined images of his final moments and his death, I realize I can't sit still anymore. So I stand up, I walk into the hallway, and I start looking for Evelyn. I find her in the kitchen with Grace. "So this is why I'm here?" I say, holding the letter in the air.
"Grace, would you mind giving us a moment?"
Grace gets up from her stool. "Sure." She disappears down the hall. When she's gone, Evelyn looks at me.
"It's not the only reason I wanted to meet you. I tracked you down to give you the letter, obviously. And I'd been looking for a way to introduce myself to you that wasn't quite so out of the blue, quite so shocking.
Vivant helped you with that, clearly."
"It gave me a pretense, yes. I felt more comfortable having a major magazine send you than calling you up on the phone and trying to explain how I knew who you were."
"So you figured you'd just lure me here with the promise of a bestseller?"
"No," she says, shaking her head. "Once I started researching you, I read most of your work. Specifically, I read your Right to Die piece."
I put the letter on the table. I consider taking a seat. "So?"
"I thought it was beautifully written. It was informed, intelligent, balanced, and compassionate. It had heart. I admired the way you deftly handled an emotional and complicated topic."
"I don't want to let her say anything nice to me, because I don't want to have to thank her for it." But my mother instilled in me a politeness that kicks in when I least expect it. "Thank you."
"When I read it, I suspected that you would do a beautiful job with my story."
"Because of one small piece I wrote?"
"Because you're talented. And if anyone could understand the complexities of who I am and what I've done, it was probably you. And the more I've gotten to know you, the more I know I was right. Whatever book you write about me, it will not have easy answers, but it will, I predict, be unflinching. I wanted to give you that letter. And I wanted you to write my story because I believe you to be the very best person for the job. So you put me through all this to assuage your guilt and make sure you got the book about your life that you wanted? Evelyn shakes her head, ready to correct me, but I'm not done. It's amazing, really, how self-interested you can be. But even now, even when you appear to want to redeem yourself, it's still about you. Evelyn puts up her hand. Don't act like you haven't benefited from this. You've been a willing participant here. You wanted the story. You took advantage, deftly and smartly, I might add, of the position I put you in. Evelyn, seriously, I say, cut the crap. You don't want the story? Evelyn asks, challenging me. If you don't want it, don't take it. Let my story die with me. That is just fine. I am quiet, unsure how to respond, unsure how I want to respond. Evelyn puts out her hand expectantly. She's not going to let the suggestion be hypothetical. It's not rhetorical. It demands an answer. Go ahead, she says. Get your notes and the recordings. We can burn them all right now. I don't move, despite the fact that she gives me ample time to do so. I didn't think so, she says. It's the least I deserve, I tell her, defensive. It's the fucking least you can give me. Nobody deserves anything, Evelyn says. It's simply a matter of who's willing to go and take it for themselves. And you, Monique, are a person who has proven to be willing to go out there and take what you want. So be honest about that. No one is just a victim or a victor. Everyone is somewhere in between. People who go around casting themselves as one or the other are not only kidding themselves, but they're also painfully unoriginal. I get up from the table and walk to the sink. I wash my hands, because I hate how clammy they feel. I dry them, I look at her. I hate you, you know. Evelyn nods. Good for you. It's such an uncomplicated feeling, isn't it, hatred? Yes, I say. It is. Everything else in life is more complex, especially your father. That's why I thought it was so important that you read that letter. I wanted you to know. What exactly? That he was innocent or that he loved a man? That he loved you like that. He was willing to turn down romantic love in order to stand by your side. Do you know what an amazing father you had? Do you know how loved you were? Plenty of men say they'll never leave their families, but your father was put to the test and didn't even blink. I wanted you to know that. If I had a father like that, I would have wanted to know. No one is all good or all bad. I know this, of course. I had to learn it at a young age. But sometimes it's easy to forget just how true it is, that it applies to everyone. Until you're sitting in front of the woman who put your father's dead body in the driver's seat of a car to save the reputation of her best friend, and you realize she held on to a letter for almost 3 decades because she wanted you to know how much you were loved. She could have given me the letter earlier. She also could have thrown it away. There's Evelyn Hugo for you, somewhere in the middle. I sit down and put my hands over my eyes, rubbing them, hoping that if I rub hard enough, maybe I can make my way to a different reality. When I open them, I'm still here. I have no choice but to resign myself to it. When can I release the book? I won't be around much longer, Evelyn says, sitting down on a stool by the island. Enough with the vagaries, Evelyn. When can I release the book? Evelyn absent-mindedly starts folding an errant napkin that is sitting haphazardly on the counter. Then she looks up at me. It's no secret that the gene for breast cancer can be inherited, she says. Although if there were any justice in the world, the mother would die of it well before the daughter. I look at the finer points of Evelyn's face. I look at the corners of her lips, the edges of her eyes, the direction of her brows. There is very little emotion in any of them.
Her face remains as stoic as if she were reading me the paper.
"You have breast cancer?" I ask.
She nods. "How far along is it?"
"Far enough for me to need to hurry up and get this done."
I look away when she looks at me. I'm not sure why.
It's not out of anger, really. It's out of shame. I feel guilty that so much of me does not feel bad for her. And stupid for the part of me that does.
"I saw my daughter go through this," Evelyn says. "I know what's ahead of me. It's important that I get my affairs in order. In addition to finalizing the last copy of my will and making sure Grace is taken care of, I handed over my most prized gowns to Christie's. And this is the last of it, that letter. And this book. You."
"I'm leaving," I say. "I can't take any more today." Evelyn starts to say something, and I stop her.
"No," I say. "I don't want to hear anything else from you. Don't say another goddamn word, okay?"
I can't say I'm surprised when she speaks, anyway.
"I was just going to say that I understand, and I'll see you tomorrow."
"Tomorrow?" I say, just as I remember that Evelyn and I aren't done.
"For the photo shoot," she says.
"I'm not sure I'm prepared to come back here."
"Well,"
Evelyn says,
"I very much hope that you do."
When I get home, I instinctively throw my bag onto the couch. I am tired, and I am angry, and my eyes feel dry and stiff as if they've been wrung out like wet laundry. I sit down, not bothering to take off my coat or my shoes. I respond to the email my mother has sent containing her flight information for tomorrow. And then I lift my legs and rest my feet on the coffee table. As I do, they hit an envelope resting on the surface. It is only then that I realize I even have a coffee table in the first place. David brought it back, and on it rests an envelope addressed to me. "M. I should never have taken the table. I don't need it. It's silly for it to sit in the storage unit. I was being petty when I left. Enclosed is my key to the apartment and the business card of my lawyer. I suppose there is not much else to say, except that I thank you for doing what I could not. D." I put the letter down on the table. I put my feet back up. I wrestle myself out of my coat. I kick off my shoes. I lay my head back. I breathe. I don't think I would have ended my marriage without Evelyn Hugo. I don't think I would have stood up to Frankie without Evelyn Hugo. I don't think I would have had the chance to write a surefire bestseller without Evelyn Hugo. I don't think I would understand the true depths of my father's devotion to me without Evelyn Hugo. So I think Evelyn is wrong about at least one thing. My hate is not uncomplicated. When I get to Evelyn's apartment in the morning, I'm unsure when I even made the actual decision to come. I simply woke up and found myself on my way. When I rounded the corner walking here from the subway, I realized I could never have not come. I cannot and will not do anything to compromise my standing at Vivant. I did not fight for writer at large to bunt at the last minute. I'm right on time, but somehow the last to arrive. Grace opens the door for me, and already looks as if a hurricane hit her. Her hair is falling out of her ponytail, and she's trying harder than usual to keep a smile on her face. "They showed up almost 45 minutes early," Grace says to me in a whisper. "Evelyn had a makeup person in at the crack of dawn to get her ready before the magazine's makeup person. She had a lighting consultant come in at 8:30 this morning to guide her on the most flattering light in the house. Turns out it's the terrace, which I have not been as diligent about cleaning because it's still cold out every day. Anyway, I've been scrubbing the terrace from top to bottom for the past 2 hours. Grace jokingly rests her head on my shoulder. Thank God I'm going on vacation.
Monique, Frankie says when she sees me in the hallway. What took you so long?
I look at my watch. It's 11:06. I remember the first day I met Evelyn Hugo. I remember how nervous I was. I remember how larger than life she seemed. She's painfully human to me now. But this is all new to Frankie. She hasn't seen the real Evelyn. She still thinks we're photographing an icon more than a person. I step out onto the terrace and see Evelyn in the midst of lights, reflectors, wires, and cameras. There are people circled around her. She is sitting on a stool. Her gray-blonde hair is being blown in the air by a wind machine. She is wearing her signature emerald green, this time in a long-sleeved silk gown. Billie Holiday is playing on a speaker somewhere. The sun is shining behind Evelyn. She looks like the very center of the universe. She is right at home. She smiles for the camera, her brown eyes sparkling in a different way from anything I've ever seen in person. She seems at peace, somehow in full display. And I wonder if the real Evelyn isn't the woman I've been talking to for the past 2 weeks, but instead the one I see before me right now. Even at almost 80, she commands a room in a way I've never seen before. A star is always and forever a star. Evelyn was born to be famous. I think her body helped her. I think her face helped her. But for the first time, watching her in action, moving in front of the camera, I get the sense that she has sold herself short in one way. She could have been born with considerably less physical gifts and probably still made it. She simply has it, that undefinable quality that makes everyone stop and pay attention. She spots me as I stand behind one of the lighting guys, and she stops what she's doing. She waves me over to her.
Everyone, everyone, she says. We need a few photos of Monique and me, please.
Oh, Evelyn, I say. I don't want to do that. I don't want to even be close to her.
Please, she says, to remember me by.
A couple of people laugh, as if Evelyn is making a joke, because, of course, no one could forget Evelyn Hugo. But I know she's serious. And so, in my jeans and blazer, I step up next to her. I take off my glasses. I can feel the heat of the lights, the way they glare in my eyes, the way the wind feels on my face.
Evelyn, I know this isn't news to you,
the photographer says,
but boy, does the camera love you.
Oh, Evelyn says, shrugging. It never hurts to hear it one more time.
Her dress is low cut, revealing her still ample cleavage, and it occurs to me that it is the very thing that made her that will be the thing that finally takes her down. Evelyn catches my eye and smiles. It is a sincere smile, a kind smile. There is something almost nurturing about it, as if she is looking at me to see how I'm doing, as if she cares. And then in an instant, I realize that she does. Evelyn Hugo wants to know that I'm okay, that with everything that has happened, I will still be all right. In a moment of vulnerability, I find myself putting my arm around her. A second after I do, I realize that I want to pull it back, that I'm not ready to be this close.
I love it, the photographer says, just like that.
I cannot pull my arm away now, and so I pretend. I pretend for one picture that I am not a bundle of nerves. I pretend that I am not furious and confused and heartbroken and torn up and disappointed and shocked and uncomfortable. I pretend that I am simply captivated by Evelyn Hugo. Because despite everything, I still am. After the photographer leaves, after everyone is cleaned up, after Frankie has left the apartment so happy that she could have sprouted wings and flown herself back to the office, I am preparing to leave. Evelyn is upstairs, changing her clothes. Grace, I say, as I spot her gathering disposable cups and paper plates in the kitchen. I wanted to take a moment to say goodbye, since Evelyn and I are done.
Done? Grace asks.
I nod. We finished up the story yesterday. Photo shoot today. Now I get to writing, I say, even though I haven't the foggiest idea how I'm going to approach any of this or what exactly my next step is.
Oh, Grace says, shrugging. I must have misunderstood. I thought you were going to be here with Evelyn through my vacation. But honestly, all I could focus on was that I had 2 tickets to Costa Rica in my hands.
That's exciting. When do you leave?
On the red eye, later,
Grace says. Evelyn gave them to me last night, for me and my husband. All expenses paid. A week. We're staying near Monteverde. All I heard was ziplining in the cloud forest, and I was sold.
You deserve it,
Evelyn says as she appears at the top of the stairs and walks down to meet us. She is in jeans and a t-shirt, but has kept her hair and makeup. She looks gorgeous, but also plain. 2 things that only Evelyn Hugo can be at once.
Are you sure you don't need me here?
I thought Monique would be around to keep you company, Grace says. Evelyn shakes her head.
No, you go. You've done so much for me lately. You need some time on your own. If something comes up, I can always call downstairs.
I don't need to...
Evelyn cuts her off.
Yes, you do. It's important that you know how much I appreciate all that you've done around here. So let me say thank you this way.
Grace smiles demurely. Okay, she says. If you insist.
I do. In fact, go home now. You've been cleaning all day, and I'm sure you need more time to pack. So go on, get out of here.
Surprisingly, Grace doesn't fight her. She merely says thank you and gathers her things. Everything seems to be happening seamlessly until Evelyn stops her on her way out and gives her a hug. Grace seems slightly surprised, though pleased.
You know, I could never have spent these past few years without you, don't you?
Evelyn says as she pulls away from her. Grace blushes.
Thank you.
Have fun in Costa Rica, Evelyn says. The time of your life.
And once Grace is out the door, I suspect I understand what is going on. Evelyn was never going to let the thing that made her be the thing to destroy her. She was never going to let anything, even a part of her body, have that sort of power. Evelyn is going to die when she wants to. And she wants to die now. Evelyn, I say, what are you? I can't bring myself to say it or even suggest it. It sounds so absurd, even the thought of it.
Evelyn Hugo taking her own life.
I imagine myself saying it out loud, and then watching Evelyn laugh at me, at how creative my imagination is, at how silly I can be. But I also imagine myself saying it and having Evelyn respond with a plain and resigned confirmation. And I'm not sure I'm ready to stomach either scenario.
Hmm?
Evelyn says, looking at me. She does not seem concerned or disturbed or nervous. She looks as if this is any normal day.
Nothing, I say.
Thank you for coming today, she says. I know you were unsure if you would be able to make it, and I'm just glad that you did.
I hate Evelyn, but I think I like her very much. I wish she had never existed, and yet I can't help but admire her a great deal.
I'm not sure what to do with that. I'm not sure what any of it means.
I turn the front doorknob. All I can manage to squeak out is the very heart of what I mean.
Please take care, Evelyn, I say.
She reaches out and takes my hand. She squeezes it briefly and then lets go.
You too, Monique, You have an exceptional future ahead of you. You will wrangle the very best out of this world. I really do believe that.
Evelyn looks at me, and for one split second, I can read her expression. It is subtle, and it is fleeting, but it is there. And I know that my suspicions are right. Evelyn Hugo is saying goodbye.
As I walk into the subway tunnel and through the turnstiles, I keep wondering if I should turn back. Should I knock on her door? Should I call 911? Should I stop her? I can walk right back up the subway steps. I can put one foot in front of the other and make my way back to Evelyn's and say, "Don't do this." I am capable of that. I just have to decide if I want to do it, if I should do it, if it's the right thing to do. She didn't pick me just because she felt she owed me. She picked me because of my right to die piece. She picked me because I showed a unique understanding of the need for dignity in death. She picked me because she believes I can see the need for mercy, even when what constitutes mercy is hard to swallow. She picked me because she trusts me. And I get the feeling she trusts me now. My train comes thundering into the station. I need to get on it and meet my mother at the airport. The doors open, the crowds flow out, the crowds flow in. A teenage boy with a backpack shoulders me out of the way. I do not set foot in the subway car. The train dings, the doors close, the station empties. And I stand there, frozen. If you think someone is going to take her own life, don't you try to stop her? Don't you call the cops? Don't you break down walls to find her? The station starts to fill again, slowly. A mother with her toddler, a man with groceries, three hipsters in flannel with beards. The crowd starts gathering faster than I can clock them now. I need to get on the next train to see my mother and leave Evelyn behind me. I need to turn around and go save Evelyn from herself. I see the two soft lights on the track that signal the train approaching. I hear the roar. My mom can get to my place on her own. Evelyn has never needed saving from anyone. The train rolls into the station, the doors open, the crowds flow out. And it is only once the doors close that I realized I've stepped inside the train. Evelyn trusts me with her story. Evelyn trusts me with her death. And in my heart, I believe it would be a betrayal to stop her. No matter how I may feel about Evelyn, I know she is in her right mind. I know she is okay. I know she has the right to die as she lived, entirely on her own terms, leaving nothing to fate or to chance, but instead holding the power of it all in her own hands. I grab the cold metal pole in front of me. I sway with the speed of the car. I change trains. I get on the air train. It is only once I'm standing at the arrivals gate and see my mother waving at me that I realize I have been nearly catatonic for an hour. There is simply too much. My father, David, the book, Evelyn. And the moment my mother is close enough to touch, I put my arms around her and sink into her shoulders. I cry. The tears that come out of me feel as if they were decades in the making. It feels as if some old version of me is leaking out, letting go, saying goodbye in the effort of making room for a new one. One that is stronger and somehow both more cynical about people and also more optimistic about my place in the world. "No, honey," my mom says, dropping her bag off her shoulder, letting it fall wherever it falls, paying no attention to the people who need to get around us. She holds me tightly, with both arms rubbing my back. I feel no pressure to stop crying. I feel no need to explain myself. You don't have to make yourself okay for a good mother. A good mother makes herself okay for you. And my mother has always been a good mother, a great mother. When I am done, I pull away, I wipe my eyes. There are people passing us on the left and the right, businesswomen with briefcases, families with backpacks. Some of them stare. But I'm used to people staring at my mother and me. Even in the melting pot that is New York City, there are still many people who don't expect a mother and daughter to look as we look. "What is it, honey?" my mom asks. "I don't even know where to start," I say. She grabs my hand. "How about I forego trying to prove to you that I understand the subway system, and we hail a cab?" I laugh and nod, drying the edges of my eyes. By the time we are in the back seat of a stale taxi, clips of the morning news cycle repeating over and over on the console, I have gathered myself enough to breathe easily. "So, tell me," she says, "what's on your mind?" Do I tell her what I know? Do I tell her that the heartbreaking thing we've always believed, that my father died driving drunk, isn't true? Am I going to exchange that transgression for another? That he was having an affair with a man when his life ended? "David and I are officially getting divorced," I say. "I'm so sorry, sweetheart," she says. "I know that had to be hard." I can't burden her with what I suspect about Evelyn. I just can't. "And I miss Dad," I say. "Do you miss Dad?" "Oh, God," she says, "every day." "Was he a good husband?" She seems caught off guard. "He was a great husband, yes," she says. "Why do you ask?" "I don't know. I guess I just realized I don't know very much about your relationship. What was he like with you?" She starts smiling, as if she's trying to stop herself but simply can't. "Oh, he was very romantic. He used to buy me chocolates every single year on the 3rd of May. I thought your anniversary was in September." "It was," she says, laughing. "He always just spoiled me on the 3rd of May for some reason. He said there weren't enough official holidays to celebrate me. He said he needed to make one up just for me." "That's really cute," I say. Our driver pulls out onto the highway. "And he used to write the most beautiful love letters," she says. "Really lovely, with poems in them about how pretty he thought I was, which was silly because I was never pretty." "Of course you were," I say. "No," she says, her voice matter of fact. "I wasn't really, but boy did he make me feel like I was Miss America." I laugh. "It sounds like a pretty passionate marriage," I say. My mom is quiet. Then she says, "No," patting my hand. "I don't know if I would say passionate. We just really liked each other. It was almost as if when I met him, I met this other side of myself. Someone who understood me and made me feel safe. It wasn't passionate, really. It was never about ripping each other's clothes off. We just knew we could be happy together. We knew we could raise a child. We also knew it wouldn't be easy and that our parents wouldn't like it. But in a lot of ways, that just brought us closer. Us against the world, sort of. I know it's not popular to say. I know everybody's looking for some sexy marriage nowadays. But I was really happy with your father. I really loved having someone to look out for me, having someone to look out for, having someone to share my days with. I always found him so fascinating. All of his opinions, his talent. We could have a conversation about almost anything, for hours on end. We used to stay up late, even when you were a toddler, just talking. He was my best friend." "Is that why you never remarried?" My mom considers the question. "You know, it's funny. Talking about passion, since we lost your dad, I found passion with men from time to time. but I'd give it all back for just a few more days with him. For just one more late-night talk.